Hello, it's Tuesday sometime in the middle. Oh, it's one of those mics. Great. It's Tuesday sometime in the middle of June, and you're listening to the Kill Radio Tuesday News. My co-host, Maria, is more likely than not stuck in public transportation, which is okay, because it's her duty to take public transportation. It's everyone's duty to take public transportation. Cars are killing us. Actually, I walked here. So, Iraq body count for today. Let me pull up the IraqBodyCount.net. Number of civilians reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. According to IraqBodyCount.net, minimum 38,475, maximum 42,889. Let's see. Let's go to a media file. This is from Stephen Colbert interviewing Congressman Westmoreland. Pretty funny stuff.
You co-sponsored a bill requiring the display of the Ten Commandments in the House of Representatives and the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Why was that important to you?
Well, the Ten Commandments is not a bad thing for people to understand and to respect.
I'm with you.
Where better place could you have something like that than in a judicial building?
Mm-hmm.
Or in a courthouse?
That is a good question. Can you think of any better building to put the Ten Commandments in than in a public building?
No. I think if we were totally without them, we may lose a sense of our direction.
What are the Ten Commandments?
What are all of them?
Mm.
You want me to name them
all?
Yeah,
please.
Don't murder, don't lie,
mm-hmm.
don't steal. I can't name them all.
Congressman, thank you for taking time away from keeping this Sabbath day holy to talk to me.
Anytime, Steve.
Now that is awkward. I love it. So, since I'm on my own today, thought it'd be nice for another edition of, man, my phone keeps going off. What's going on here? Some crazy stuff. Whoa. There's a voicemail. I'll check that later. I want to first read for you this, from Mom's emails. This was one of my mother's many forwards. This is George W. Bush's resume as of now. Education and experience. Law enforcement. I was arrested in Kennebunkport, Maine, 1976 for driving under the influence of alcohol. I pled guilty, paid a fine, and had my driver's license suspended for 30 days. My Texas driving record has been lost and is not available. Military. I joined the Texas Air National Guard and went AWOL. Refused to take a drug test or answer any questions about my drug use. By joining the Texas Air National Guard, I was able to avoid combat duty in Vietnam. College. I graduated from Yale University with a low C average. I was a cheerleader. Past work experience. I ran for U.S. Congress and lost. I began my career in the oil business in Midland, Texas in 1975. I bought an oil company but couldn't find any oil in Texas. The company went bankrupt shortly after I sold all my stock. I bought the Texas Rangers baseball team in a sweetheart deal that took land using taxpayer money. With the help of my father and our right-wing friends in the oil industry, including Enron CEO Ken Lay, I was elected governor of Texas. Accomplishments as governor of Texas. I changed Texas pollution laws to favor power and oil companies, making Texas the most polluted state in the union. During my tenure, Houston replaced Los Angeles as the most smog-ridden city in America. I cut taxes and bankrupted the Texas Treasury to the tune of billions in borrowed money. I set the record for the most executions by any governor in American history. With the help of my brother, the governor of Florida, and my father's appointments to the Supreme Court, I became president after losing by over 500,000 votes. Accomplishments as president. I am the first president in U.S. history to enter office with a criminal record. I invaded and occupied two countries at a continuing cost of over $1 billion per week. I spent the U.S. surplus and effectively bankrupted the U.S. Treasury. I shattered the record for the largest annual deficit in U.S. history. I set an economic record for most private bankruptcies filed in any 12-month period. Set the all-time record for most foreclosures in a 12-month period. I set the all-time record for the biggest drop in the history of the U.S. stock market. In my first year in office, over 2 million Americans lost their jobs, and that trend continues every month. I'm proud that the members of my cabinet are the richest of any administration in U.S. history. My quote-unquote poorest millionaire, Condoleezza Rice, has a Chevron oil tanker named after her. I set the record for most campaign fundraising trips by a U.S. president. I am the all-time U.S. and world record holder for receiving the most corporate campaign donations. My largest lifetime campaign contributor and one of my best friends, Kenneth Lay, presided over the largest corporate bankruptcy fraud in U.S. history, Enron. My political party used Enron private jets and corporate attorneys to assure my success with the U.S. Supreme Court during my election decision. I have protected my friends at Enron and Halliburton against investigation or prosecution. More time and money was spent investigating the Monica Lewinsky affair than has been spent investigating one of the biggest corporate ripoffs in history. I presided over the biggest energy crisis in U.S. history and refused to intervene when corruption involving the oil industry was revealed. I presided over the highest gasoline prices in U.S. history. I changed the U.S. policy to allow convicted criminals to be awarded government contracts. I appointed more convicted criminals to administration than any president in U.S. history. I created the Ministry of Homeland Security, the largest bureaucracy in the history of the United States government. I've broken more international treaties than any president in U.S. history. I am the first president in U.S. history to have the United Nations remove the U.S. from the Human Rights Commission. I withdrew the U.S. from the World Court of Law. I refused to allow inspectors access to U.S. prisoners of war, detainees, and thereby have refused to abide by the Geneva Convention. I am the first president in history to refuse United Nations election inspectors during the 2002 U.S. election. I set the record for fewest number of press conferences of any president since the advent of television. I set the all-time record for most days on vacation in any one-year period. After taking off the entire month of August, I presided over the worst security failure in U.S. history. I garnered the most sympathy for the U.S. after the World Trade Center attacks, and less than a year later made the U.S. the most hated country in the world, the largest failure of diplomacy in world history. I have set the all-time record for most people worldwide to simultaneously protest me in public venues, 15 million people, shattering the record for protest against any person in the history of mankind. I am the first president in U.S. history to order an unprovoked preemptive attack and the military occupation of a sovereign nation. I did so against the will of the United Nations, the majority of U.S. citizens, and the world community. I have cut health care benefits for war veterans and support a cut in duty benefits for active duty troops and their families in wartime. In my State of the Union address, I lied about our reasons for attacking Iraq, then blamed the lies on our British friends. I am the first president in history to have a majority of Europeans, 71%, view my presidency as the biggest threat to world peace and security. I am supporting development of a nuclear tactical bunker buster, a WMD. I have so far failed to fulfill my pledge to bring Osama bin Laden to justice. Records and references. All records of my tenure as governor of Texas are now in my father's library, sealed and unavailable for public view. All records of SEC investigations into my insider trading and my bankrupt companies are sealed in secrecy and unavailable for public view. All records or minutes from meetings that I or my vice president attended regarding public energy policy are sealed in secrecy and unavailable for public review. Please consider my experience and my party when voting in 2006. There you have it, folks. I'm going to play the... I'm going to play the Colbert thing again because that is hilarious.
Co-sponsored a bill requiring the display of the Ten Commandments in the House of Representatives and the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Why was that important to you?
Well, the Ten Commandments is not a bad thing for people to understand and to respect.
I'm with you.
Where better place could you have something like that than in a judicial building or in a courthouse?
That is a good question. Can you think of any better building to put the Ten Commandments in than in a public building?
No. I think if we were totally without them, we may lose a sense of our direction.
What are the Ten Commandments?
What are all of them? Mm. You want me to name them
all?
Yeah,
please.
Don't murder. Don't lie. Mm-hmm. Don't steal. I can't name them all.
Congressman, thank you for taking time away from keeping the Sabbath day holy.
Anytime, Steve.
I am joined by Starsky Suave of the people who do that.
Am I in? Am I on? Is it in? Is this
yes,
thing working?
You are the person who is doing that. Mary is not here today. My guess is she's in a public transit fiasco.
Oh.
But I had a...
Sorry, I just opened up a
new
window.
No, that's fine. That's
just
fine.
A minute. Oh, okay.
I was looking for an article. Yeah, there it is. Of course.
Hook me up.
Because we're live. We're having internet problems. Clicking on things and they're not
yeah,
doing
where,
what
where's
you normally
the instantaneity?
Do yes.
Well, I
definitive
know.
Lack of instantaneity. Well, anyway, so
from the KureRadio.org newsroom, this is live news with live delays.
Connection has timed out.
Well, time me out.
Hey, you saw Inconvenient Truth, did you not?
That's an affirmative.
Tell me about that. You went to like a special screening of it, didn't you?
I was at the California Plaza, downtown, Grand Avenue, big event, which was the free screening of An Inconvenient Truth with live, presently, the in presence of the present former president, actual elected president, Al Gore was there.
The un-president?
The un-president, kind of like the un-cola. Don't you feel good about ha 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 sitting up? Anyway, we got there just in time to miss the speech by Al Gore, but just in time to catch the live acoustic performance from Jon Bon Jovi.
Wow.
And I was just commenting earlier about the fact that, you know, in the context of the environmental crisis that we're trying to overcome, he was singing a song in which he said that we should take his hand because... we'll make it, he swears. But then later in the song, Jon Bon Jovi said it doesn't really matter if we make it or not. And I thought that was a mixed message, and I was a little upset about it, but I couldn't address that to him, so I just had to stay there and listen. And then later on, he asserted that he is a cowboy and that he rides on a steel horse.
Oh.
And apparently some people want him in either one of two forms, dead or alive.
Best lyric by Jon Bon Jovi ever.
Bring
is,
it on. What is it?
Is... I'm going to live my life every day.
Damn. That's not quite as deep, though, as...
Isn't that the most...
As Sinead O'Connor saying that she does not want what she hasn't got. Even though, by definition, the word want requires you to not have something, you have to want things that you don't have. Because as soon as you have them, you can't want them. You've got them.
But and also, by definition, being alive implies that...
You're going to live your life every day.
Every day you are... Alive.
Well, I'm a little different from Jon Bon Jovi. I like to live my life every other day. So take that.
Interesting. Interesting. So what did you think of the movie?
Oh, yeah, the movie. Right. Well, what I thought was curious is that it's a combination of getting the issue and the points out about global warming and giving you an update on what Al Gore has been going through since you last saw him on the public stage. So it was a little combination, a dual-purpose movie where you got to have a little update on Al Gore and you got to have the details on global warming. And it was kind of funny because he characterizes what he's doing now as going around the country, showing a slideshow. And it's so anticlimactic, but it's kind of funny. But it's true. That's what he's doing. And, yeah, it's not a big old blockbuster amazing movie. It's pretty much Al Gore doing a slideshow or a movie of Al Gore doing a slideshow. In spite of that, it's still very good, I think, very well done, and it's easy to grasp, and it really, I think, puts the information out there in a way that I hope will have the effect of bypassing all the bullshit spin that goes on, artificial controversy that gets drummed up. Well, we aren't really sure that these things are happening. Let's wait a little longer.
Do you think it was technically a good movie? Or are you just saying that it's a good movie because it's a topic of interest that you think needs to be discussed? You know, do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, content versus cinematography or whatever.
Well, like you could say that, what's it called? Like Fahrenheit 9/11. Like, I'm likely to call that a good movie because I really enjoyed the content, but it's safe to say that technically it's not a very good documentary.
Let me take it even better. I think it was effective on many levels. A better example would be, I think, say, what's it called? Outfoxed.
Okay, yeah, I saw that.
It's not a very well-done movie.
No,
it's pretty low-budget, and it's not really that great. But the content is pretty amazing, and it's pretty cool for what it does. So I think that it's effective on that level, but I wouldn't call it like a really well-done movie. And so then as far as Inconvenient Truth, I think it is pretty well-done, pretty well-polished. It's just not a typical movie in the sense of it's not even a typical documentary. It really is like footage of a slideshow, which is weird.
Do you think it would be as well watched as you know, if it weren't done by Al Gore?
Two things.
If it was just a documentary about global warming,
I think it wouldn't. And there's two reasons. One is because it's featuring Al Gore. I think that helps. But the other issue is this: it's not just here's a movie we're putting out and let's hope for the best. He's going around to every city and accompanying that movie with his presence, which I think does make a difference. It's like he's trying to amp up the effect of his normal going around doing the slideshow, and now it's a movie. And it all is still pretty simple, but maybe that's what's good about it. So I think it is going to be more effective, yes, because he's involved with it, and because he's in person. He's going around and accompanying that movie with his entourage.
It's tricky because so many people seriously dislike him. And I'm not even talking about Republicans because...
Yeah.
You know, who knows what goes on in the minds of a Republican. But I do wonder about, you know, there are a lot of Democrats and progressives who feel very strongly that Al Gore is not a very good representative. And I wonder if that in some way takes away from the movie. But should that even matter? Because, you know, the question really is the movie political at all?
You know, yes,
obviously
it is.
Everyone says it's political because there are politicians who are putting an effort into trying to disprove global warming.
Yeah.
But on the face of it, it's no more political than, you know, bird flu.
Well, look, the issue needn't be political.
Maybe bird flu is political. I don't know.
Maybe. The issue needn't be political, but the movie certainly is. I mean, he's, like I say, it's part global warming, part the saga of Al Gore. And so in the process of bringing out the saga of Al Gore, we do address things like what the fuck this administration is doing now, what the fuck they did to steal the election. All that kind of stuff is brought up in there. It's definitely particle. It's definitely political. He's not avoiding those issues. He addresses those. And it's kind of weird to have the two. It's like you would almost think, do you want to dilute that message? Do you want to just have a global warming thing? Well, I think people will be interested in knowing where Al Gore is coming from. So it kind of is germane because you get to see Senator Al Gore way back when.
Yeah. No, my biggest complaint about the movie was that there were some things thrown in there in an attempt to make it entertaining. Like
the Simpsons-esque
like little
thing.
Cartoons and stuff like that. Yeah. Where like it was obvious that he's like, you know, this shit's pretty boring. I'm going to throw in something here that's kind of cutesy. But you're talking about, you know, the end of civilization. I mean, it's just not funny. You know, and there's really no way to
But still, think about what those elements were. We're talking about, like, the one that I'm sure was illustrated by Matt Groening. And it's not Simpsons characters, but it might as well be. And what that was doing was illustrating the bullshittiness of the debate contra global warming. You know?
Yeah.
That's what that was just a little trope for, and I think that was effective. It wasn't like they were trying to take the whole issue and say, oh, here's a funny cartoon.
But they do that a lot in documentaries, though.
Yeah.
Because it's like we have to really kind of give an excuse for people to watch this because otherwise it's like being at school.
Yeah.
One of the things that I just think is really – it's interesting how any subject matter that is really scary becomes political, even if it's not intended to be political, because, you know, like a good example is like Fast Food Nation, the book Fast Food Nation. Eric Schlosser got a lot of flack when he wrote that book because of his, you know, quote unquote attacks on Republicans. Well, it just so happened that he was writing a book about the fast food industry and the way meat is prepared and distributed. And it just so happens that the Republican Party, not the Democratic Party, was the party behind, you know, fighting against all of the laws that we now have that protect the way our meat is made. The Republicans were backing the meatpacking industry 100% at the risk of everyone's health, no matter what. And so then it becomes political when you point out that, you know, oh, we would have these, you know, these laws that protect our health were not for Republican efforts to blah, 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 blah. And then they go, oh, well, you're just a Democrat. You're sort of negating the fact that you just pointed out a truism. And one of the problems we have with global warming is like, okay, I'm willing to accept that the science isn't finished. You know, the science isn't finished on evolution either. But, you know, I'm the kind of guy that goes with pretty much whatever the scientists are saying, more or less. But I'm ready for some debate, if there's going to be some real debate. But we don't have real debate. What we have are Republicans who are going out of their way to disprove not the facts of global warming,
motivation,
but the existence of global warming.
Yeah, right.
They can't really argue the facts because the facts are on global warming side. So that what they can say, what they can do, is kind of show how global warming is a Democratic political issue, instead of actually arguing the actual points of global warming, because they can't, because they're wrong. But it doesn't serve their interest to say, oh, yeah, we have a real problem, because they represent the major corporations.
Who do not want to have to take the steps to work towards solving that problem.
Exactly.
But what's great that's illustrated in that movie is funny stuff. It's like, dumbasses, all you can think of is profits, and not just short-term profits, but short-term profits. You want so bad to drill in this nearly Arctic area, your trucks can't even drive to bring your shit back because the permafrost is melting and it's unpassable. So, guess what? It's against your economic interest to ignore it, too.
It's against their economic interest in the future. The problem with the Republicans is that they're fatalists.
Yeah.
They don't believe in God. They don't believe in an afterlife. They believe that they're here to make money. And if their children and their grandchildren can't breathe the air and can't eat the food, well, fuck them, because they don't pay taxes yet.
Yeah, and they're not gonna, because the estate tax will be repealed.
Exactly. I really think that's the mentality, that it's sort of a logical illogic. Chomsky actually talks about this in some detail in some of his essays about how, you know, it, like you said, it makes absolutely no sense why they would defend some policies that ultimately don't serve their interests, but they serve their interests now. It's ultimately not in the interest of anybody for us to be occupying Iraq, and I don't think any logical person can argue that it is. But it is definitely in the interest of some to be in, you know, in a state of war in Iraq right now.
Sure, yeah, there's money to be made.
So there it is. Wow, I didn't realize that that wire extended that far.
Yeah. Do you have something for me to transmit while you
might,
make...
you might want to read this interesting article that came up about Bush and the Constitution.
Yeah, this is like the crossing your fingers while you say, I'll do it syndrome that Bush is...
Exactly.
So
and I'll be right back. You're listening to the Cub Radio Tuesday News.
From the Associated Press, dated today, we have an article entitled Senate Holds Hearings on Bush's Use of Signing Statements. The White House on Tuesday defended President Bush's frequent use of special statements that claim authority to limit the effects of bills he signs, saying the statements help him uphold the Constitution and defend national security. Senators weren't so sure. It's a challenge to the plain language of the Constitution, said Arlen Specter, a Republican whose Senate Judiciary Committee opened hearings on the issue. There is a sense that the president has taken signing statements far beyond the customary purview. At the White House, Press Secretary Tony Snow, also known as Snowjob, said, "There's this notion that the president is committing acts of civil disobedience, and he's not. It's important for the president to at least to express reservations about the constitutionality of certain provisions. And we all know what a constitutional scholar he is." The bill's signing statements say Bush reserves a right to revise, interpret, or disregard measures on national security and constitutional grounds. Some 110 statements have challenged about 750 statutes passed by Congress, according to numbers combined from White House and Senate Committee. They include documents revising or disregarding parts of legislation to ban torture of detainees and to renew the Patriot Act. Snow said presidents from Dwight Eisenhower to Bill Clinton have issued such statements. The president has done the same thing that his predecessors have, he told reporters, also known as the, hey, look, Clinton did it, defense. Presidents generally had the same concerns about defending the presidential prerogatives when it comes to national security. In addition to Specter's objections, Democrats called the signing statements an example of the administration trying to expand executive power. I believe that this new use of signing statements is a means to undermine and weaken the law, said Senator Dianne Feinstein of California. If the president is going to have the power to nullify all or part of a statute, it should only be through the veto authority that the president has authorized and can reject, rather than through a unilateral action taken outside the structure of our democracy. Defending Bush, a Justice Department lawyer said the September 11th attacks had made it prudent for the president to protect his powers with signing statements more than did his predecessors. Of course it's September 11th. That's always the reason. Even if there is a modest increase, let me just suggest that it be viewed in light of current events and Congress's response to those events, said lawyer Michelle Boardman. The significance of legislation affecting national security has increased markedly since September 11th. Congress has been more active. The president has been more active, she added. He's really clearing a lot of brush. Oh, no, she didn't say that. The separation of powers is working when we have this kind of dispute. Bullshit. The exchange came during a midterm election year in which Specter, some fellow Republicans, and many Democrats are highlighting the concerns about the administration's use of executive power. Specter's personal list includes Bush's warrantless domestic wiretapping program, the administration's checking of phone records, and the sending of officials to hearings, but saying they cannot answer lawmakers' questions on national security grounds.
Oh, yeah.
The session also was aimed at countering any influence Bush's signing statements may have on court decisions regarding the new laws. Courts can be expected to look at the legislature for intent, not the executive, said Senator John Cornyn, Republican of Texas, a former state judge. The president is entitled to express his opinion. It's the courts that determine what the law is, he said. I don't know why the issue of presidents issuing signing statements is controversial at all. Specter and his allies maintain that Bush is trying an end run around the veto process. In his presidency's sixth year, Bush has yet to issue a single veto. Veto, veto, veto. Which could be overridden with a two-thirds majority in each house. The president is not required to, Boardman said. Of course he's not if he signs the bill, Specter snapped back. Other presidents have used signing statements for administrative reasons, such as instructing an agency how to put a certain law into effect. They usually are inserted quietly into the federal record.
Thank you, Starsky, for lending your wonderful voice.
Oh, thank you.
And now, a musical interlude. This is a song called Brain on a Stick by a band, local LA band called Pedestrian. It's about the president.
How many
this and I'll bask in it.
Moving into the Gaza Strip. Right now we're getting word and we're getting live pictures in from the southern part of Gaza. Israeli troops moving in. There's been escalated tension in recent weeks, building up over the past few days to the kidnapping of one Israeli soldier at a checkpoint inside Israel along the border with Gaza. Two other Israeli soldiers were killed in that incident. The Israelis have been negotiating to try to get their captive soldier returned. That has not happened. Paula Hancox is joining us on the phone from Jerusalem. A lot of people have been bracing for the planes and the tanks by the Israelis to move into Gaza. That's precisely, Paula, I take it, what's happening right now.
That's right, Wolf, yes. This is a scenario that Prime Minister Ehud Olmert had threatened would happen if the Palestinian militants did not hand back the Israeli soldier they kidnapped on Sunday. Now, they have not handed that soldier back, and the troops we can see now are moving into the southern part of Gaza. Now, for a couple of days, we've seen thousands of Israeli ground troops, tanks, armored vehicles, all lining up on the border, getting ready for either the order to go into Gaza or to retreat. Obviously, that order has come in that they will go into Gaza. Now, we're hearing from Palestinian security officials that ground troops are taking up positions around the town of Rafah. Now, this is right on the southern tip of Gaza, very close to the Egyptian border. We understand that these troops are amassing around that particular area itself. We also know in the past couple of hours, in preparation presumably for this particular incursion, airstrikes have been carried out by the Israeli Air Force. They've taken out two bridges which join up the northern and southern parts of Gaza. So they've basically isolated the northern and southern parts of Gaza. And in addition, they've taken out the one and only power plant in Gaza as well. So the Israelis are making sure that power has been taken out for much of Gaza.
Finally, some bad news from the Middle East. Tired of everything going so well there. And now we have Hamas, can you believe it, failing to communicate with Israel. And once again, Israel rolling in the tanks into one of the most impoverished places in the world, the Gaza Strip.
More impoverished than the United States?
Yes, quite. Quite. I don't want to get all political on your asses or anything. I'm just saying that...
It's not like it's a news show or anything like that.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't like to talk about Israel too much because it's such a... It's kind of like global warming. It's one of those things where it's like, okay, well, there are facts and then there are illusions. Mm-hmm. And there are people who, on both sides of the issue, who prefer to stick with the illusions than the facts, mm-hmm. and it makes it impossible to have like a real conversation about it because people's emotions are so wrapped up in it.
Right, and it's
I don't know that people's emotions are as wrapped up in global warming as they are in Israel, but the idea being that you rarely hear an actual like. Normal, like legitimate discussion right. about what's actually going on and what's been going on there over the past 40 years.
Yeah, it's such an age-old problem, too, isn't it?
Well, but that's part of the illusion. It's really only a 40- or 50-year-old problem, which is age-old for someone like me who's in his late 20s, but technically is not really age-old in the way you think of, problems in other parts of the world that have been going on for centuries.
Oh, well, I thought Israel had been having problems for quite a long time.
Israel's only been around for a little over 50 years.
What was it before that? Well, it wasn't Israel?
Well, no, it was before that it was part of the Ottoman Empire. Well, between that, it was, you know, the UK had partitioned it into what it called the, you know, the territories, and there was various documents written up saying, you know, this part Palestinian, this part to be reserved for a future Zionist state, yada, yada, yada. But before it was, in terms of officially, like, map-wise, before it was the state of Israel, it was just a part of the Ottoman Empire, which was defeated in World War One.
Okay, but weren't there in World War One?
Yeah.
So this is since the 19.
Well, since like the 1917 ish, or so, it was became like a British protectorate, and then in 1948, the British were asked with bullets to leave, And the state of Israel was declared.
Okay. But even before that, weren't there problems?
Well, I mean, that's an issue. That's an issue of debate. There are people who will tell you that Israelis, the Jews and Muslims have never gotten along. Mm-hmm. And then there are people who will ask you, well, then how come there's so many Jews in the Middle East?
Hmm.
Why would they go there? There's very little historical evidence of sustained conflict between those two peoples before the creation of the state of Israel. But you have to understand that the Israeli Jews living in the state of Israel are not indigenous to that area. It's made up largely of European and American immigrants. So the conflict is between essentially white Westerners and indigent Muslims. And there's enough craziness to go around on both sides. So, you know, the problem with an issue like that is, besides the actual technical conflict of like, you know, hey, this is my land. No, it's my land. I mean, you see that all over the world. There's also the religious conflict. And the religious conflict, you know, how do you resolve a religious conflict? You know, my invisible man in the sky hates your invisible man in the sky. And on both sides, you have people who would rather die than see the other side, you know, win even just a little bit.
Is it really about religion or is it just about power? Because many times people say, oh, that it's a war over religion, but it's actually a power struggle. You know, one group wants to say this is our land and we want, you know, as in the case of Northern Ireland, for example, where they say it's Catholics versus Protestants, but it's really, a lot of other people are saying it's really England versus Ireland, Ireland wanting to be independent of England.
I think you have to weigh the percentages. I think you're probably right that most of it is political. Most of it is about power and control and things like that. And a lot of it is, of course, has to do with American and British influence and making sure that the oil flows in our direction. And,
oh,
you know,
oil.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's more oil stuff, huh?
But, well, oil and, you know, what we call democracy and things like that, you know, But there's also the religion is a part of it in the sense that there are right-wing fanatics on both sides of the issue who believe it to be a religious struggle, and they believe it enough that they're willing to kill others and in some cases kill themselves to prove that point.
Well, this is like here, you know, people are suggesting that what's happening here is a religious struggle, and yet there are many people who don't see it that way. They don't think George Bush is trying to set up a theocracy. They think that George Bush is not really a Christian, but he's just claiming to be a Christian to start conflict and to try to get people to form an alliance with him. And so I just wonder if it's a similar kind of thing.
I think there are definite similarities. But I mean, and similarly to this conflict, I don't know how it can be resolved. I mean, one of the many reasons why, you know, I don't see any kind of peaceful resolution to the Israeli-Palestinian crisis is that even if you get decent men in charge of both representative governments, and that's assuming that you're able to get representative governments of both sides, of which I do not believe is possible anyway, even if you're able to do that, there will still be some crazy bastard who is going to screw it up for us, for everyone. There's still going to be a percentage of people with access to weapons who are religious enough to commit horrible atrocities. And this is true of both sides. I mean, they're...
But, I mean, are they... Well, I guess my question is, are they really religious? Or are they claiming to be religious to just get people to follow them?
No, and I think they believe themselves to be religious.
You think so? I mean...
I do. As an outsider, I can point at that and say, okay, that's not true Islam, and that's definitely not what Judaism is about. And yeah, and I can, you know, as a non-Christian, I can look at George W. Bush and just be amazed at how he can call himself a Christian and do so many things that are against what I understand the philosophy of Christianity to be. Mm-hmm. However, I do think that he believes himself to be a Christian, and I do think that these people who commit atrocities in the Middle East believe themselves to be religious. It's just that their beliefs are distorted by, you know, years and years of their environment, of being brainwashed by their environment.
Yeah, there is that point of view, and that's a very widely held point of view. But of course, as, no pun intended, the devil's advocate, I would have to say that I think that those people are just using religion. I mean, in the case of George Bush, I don't think he cares at all about same-sex marriage. And, of course, Dick Cheney's daughter, Mary Cheney, is a lesbian, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't really think that they care at all about those issues. And I don't really think that they are truly Christians.
I think that's different than the... than what we see in the Muslim world, though, where you have religious clerics who have bent and twisted the meaning of their religion to suit political aims. Mm. So it does, in that sense, it works to their advantage. And maybe those leaders aren't really truly in their heart of hearts religious. Mm. You know, they're just conniving. Mm. But the people that they are brainwashing, that they're raising to be suicide bombers, or they're raising to be murderers in one capacity or another, those people believe themselves to be religious, and they look up to these leaders as religious people, mm-hmm. in much the same way that we see in the religious right in the United States, where the followers do believe themselves to be religious, but the leaders, mm-hmm. who knows what they think, because it seems from the outside that how could they be religious, mm-hmm. and commit so much murder and so much theft and tell so many lies.
Right. And I noticed, like, well, at least here with the religious right out here, with the ones I have met, I noticed that they really believe everything that George Bush says. They don't see the lies. They don't see the dishonesty. You know, they really think that George Bush is telling the truth, that we're fighting Iraq because of September 11th. You know, there are people who think that we were attacked by Iraq.
There are so many people who think that.
Yeah,
and who use it in, you know, like a normal thing. Like, you know, I don't understand the liberals, and, you know, they sell these horrible things. Don't they know we're at war to defend ourselves because of what was done to us, and we had to go into Iraq, and blah, blah, blah. And, like, when you throw in something like, but, like, you know, the guys who did September 11th, they were from Saudi Arabia, right? And then they kind of, you see this, like, little thing in their eye, like they know it. Like, they'd heard it somewhere, but it doesn't, you know, jive with their philosophy. So they're like, oh, well, you know, you got to start somewhere. And, you know.
So then it just gets to the point of, you know, where, I mean, those people might truly be religious or truly be Christian or whatever, but they really are sort of ignorant. I mean, they don't really know what's happening in the world, or they're not informed, or they're just trusting their leaders are telling them the truth, and their leaders are lying to them, but because they believe that anyone who calls themselves a Christian has to be telling the truth, and people who don't call themselves Christians have to be lying, and it's so Christianity sort of becomes, rather than a religious tradition, it's become sort of like a, I don't know, kind of a nationality or a culture or some sort of you know, race or something.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that it's, and people aren't even thinking about what the religions teach.
I don't think this is unique to Christianity at all. I mean, I think you see this in the Jewish world and the Muslim world just as much. It's the problem is, one of the problems with religion in general is that the stricter you are, the closer you are to following the doctrine of the religion, the more emphasis there is on faith and believing in your leaders and trusting in people above you, and in the idea of power being hierarchical, that there's, you know, things that are greater than you and you just have to believe it. And even if it doesn't make sense, you have to follow it because that's what you're told to do. And that's, blind justice and all that stuff.
Yeah, although I have to say in the Bible it does warn against following your religious leaders. It says you should follow God, the higher law of God, and not follow the
see, but
the
this
people,
is, this
the
is
religious
a good example.
Leaders.
Like you're saying that, and you're taking a part of the Bible and emphasizing it.
Right.
Because it reflects your philosophy, and I think it's a decent philosophy.
It's not really such a small part, though. I mean, that's why Jesus was killed. Because Jesus said, you know, I'm the Son of God, listen to me. Don't listen to your religious leaders. Don't just blindly follow organized religion. The religious leaders at the time were sort of like the neocons of today. They saw their power being threatened mm-hmm. and wanted people to, you know, to follow them and to give them money, and they just wanted their political power. So they had to have Jesus killed.
Right, but it's what I'm saying is the Bible is a big book and it's intentionally contradictory in many places. So when you say that you have to, not just not follow your religious leaders, but put your faith in the law of God, that opens it up to, you know, so much debate. What is the law of God? You know, I mean. Is law of God the part of the Bible where they talk about how much a slave is worth? Or, you know, is it the part where it says thou shalt not kill and then two pages later is a list of about 100 reasons people should be put to death?
Well, I don't know if the Bible suggests that people should be put to death.
Oh, no. I mean, it does. I mean, I could show you the pages where it says the reasons, you know, this is about, I don't know, between 50 and 100 of them, like reasons why people should, it's a, you know, thou shalt be put to death. And sometimes it's by fire and sometimes it's by other things.
Oh, bring it in.
I will. I'll bring in the Bible next time I come in. No, I happen to have read it, so I know. But, you know, you could debate the meaning of it. You know, there could be a non-literal interpretation. Man who sleeps with man who sleeps with woman shall be put to death. That's a quote from the Bible. But maybe that means he should be shunned from society. Maybe it doesn't literally mean that someone should kill him.
Mm-hmm.
There are various... you know, laws that you can, that are, if they're broken in the Bible, the punishment is stoning, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But do they mean literally stoning like they used to do, like get people in the corner and throw rocks at them? Or is that a parable, you know, a metaphor?
But then in the New Testament, then Jesus says, whoever has not sinned should cast the first stone.
Yeah. And he says, you know, maybe you shouldn't follow all these rules. Maybe some of them are a little messed up.
Well, I mean, I think basically what he was saying is it should be, you know, your faith should come from your heart, and it's not so much what you appear to be publicly. And
but I think that's an interpretive philosophy of Christianity. That's one way of looking at Christianity, and it's obviously, you know, it's a positive one. It's a humanist one.
Well,
it's not an uncommon one.
That's the New Testament version, and the New Testament version is more positive than the Old Testament.
Well, the Old Testament is essentially a chronology of war. It follows the tribes from one area to the other and sort of sorts out, you know, how God led them to the promised land and what are the rules that he set down. I mean, you read Exodus and Leviticus. I mean, it's just like rule after rule after rule after rule.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, in the New Testament is sort of like, hey, you know, we had these rules and, you know, they're kind of hard to follow and maybe we shouldn't follow all of them so literally. And, you know, here's some new ideas and stuff like that. And obviously that's going to cause controversy in a world of people who their whole lives have been following these unfollowable rules.
Well, you know, the other thing is the Bible's translated from several different languages. So.
And there are several different interpretations of the New Testament. I mean, you refer to it as lighter than the Old Testament, but there are darker interpretations of the New Testament. There's the King James Bible, which is different than, you know, than other New Testaments.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the New Testament, if you get a King James Bible, so the books are actually in a different order than if you were to read just the traditional Hebrew text of the Old Testament, because the King James Bible is rewritten so that the Old Testament leads up to the arrival of Christ
mm-hmm.
in a more chronological way. Because it's written by people is the problem.
But how is it darker? Or, I mean, what is the dark version of the New Testament?
No, I'm saying that there are, you know, you have different offshoots of Christianity that interpret the New Testament differently. Obviously, Catholicism and Protestantism and Episcopalian, blah, 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 blah.
Oh, yeah, you do. But, I mean, I think however they People can choose to interpret the Bible however they wish to. But I think the Bible does make certain things pretty clear. I mean, the idea that you should love others as you love yourself.
Yeah, but wouldn't you agree that there are also certain ways of teaching Christianity that put an emphasis on punishment and sin and eternal hellfire and resisting pleasure, things like that?
There are always different interpretations of anything.
Well, yeah.
But I think the Bible pretty much makes it clear, makes certain things clear, you know, about not killing other people, you know, loving others as you love yourself, and not casting the first stone. I think the Bible pretty much emphasizes kindness and peace and love and all the things that George Bush does not stand for. I mean, personally, like, I look at George Bush and I think Christian.
Right.
I mean, it's just so obvious. I mean, I wonder whether he's a Satanist, which has been a rumor for a very long time.
Well, it's funny because when I was talking to Starsky before about the An Inconvenient Truth, I was sort of half joking that, you know, he's obviously doesn't believe in anything. The Republicans, I don't know if they're what they are, but, you know, they're able to look at things that have to affect them as human beings on mm-hmm. Earth, and yet they're willing to do things that guarantee their failure in the future, mm-hmm. but not now, because right. they're fatalist. This thing, like, they don't care about the next generation. They care about the now.
Right.
So go ahead and let the, you know, go ahead and challenge the scientists on global warming and, mm-hmm. and put out propaganda that suggests that global warming doesn't exist, because that will allow your buddies who run these major corporations who helped you get in office to continue to mm-hmm. make as much money as they can mm-hmm. and give you as much of that as they can so that you can run for office next time. And that's a good thing. And mm-hmm. if the end result is, you know, global devastation, well, you're not going to be around to see it anyway.
Right,
you know,
right.
I mean, you have to wonder, doesn't Bush eat the meat that we all eat, right? Mm. Doesn't he have to have a hamburger sometimes?
Right.
Right? And yet he's willing to back these, you know, meatpacking standards as low as possible because that benefits the people who contributed right. to his campaign.
Well, this is going to sound off the wall sort of conspiracy theory here, but I actually met someone who had some encounters with Satanists. And before I met this person, I actually didn't believe that Satanists existed. I thought that was just like Republican propaganda. You know, if you listen to heavy metal and you dress in black, you're a Satanist.
There are people who worship desk chairs. I mean,
right.
you know, something for everyone.
Yeah, I didn't think that there were really true, like real true honest Satanists, but I actually met someone who counseled victims of satanic cult abuse.
That's just a screensaver.
It was really strange and bizarre what this person told me. Apparently, there are people who really do worship Satan, and according to this person, they really believe in destroying everything that's good in the world, like everything that's good and pure and innocent. That's really their goal.
Mm-hmm.
And they try to get people to fight with each other and argue with each other in their daily life. And this was a very reliable source who told me this. I mean, this was someone who counseled a victim of it, and told me that they purposely abuse their children in order to destroy any sense of right and wrong in them, to turn them into sort of sociopaths, you know, to desensitize them.
And they were probably abused as children themselves.
Possibly, yeah. But apparently they purposely do it. You know, it's a conscious thing that they do.
I don't think anybody abuses their children by accident. I mean, I know it's a different discussion,
Like some people don't realize they're abusing their kids, you know, because they might have mental problems or drug
right.
or alcohol problems, and they don't.
What do you think is the sort of biological, like evolutionary argument for why someone would adopt that philosophy? Like, ultimately, we're all fighting for our own survival, right? We do whatever we think is going to keep us around.
Right.
Like, the one thing we're all programmed to do is not die.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think goes through a Satanist's mind when he thinks of living a life of obliterating good? What do you think he gets?
I'm not sure. One thing I had heard...
Because their reward in hell kind of thing?
Well, from a different source, what I'd heard... the Satanists that you hear that are popular, like... and what's his name? Antoine LaVey.
Ann Coulter?
There's one. There are some people who publicly announced that they're Satanists, and they say that they're just having fun, that they don't want to believe that there's a sense of right and wrong in the world, because they want to be able to just party all the time and have a good time and go to orgies or whatnot and not have to worry about whether something's right or wrong.
Is that the same thing as Satanism? Because I thought Satanism was the practice of worshiping Satan. I mean, a lot of people live in a world where they bring into question what's right and wrong, and they live a life of perhaps values and morals that are different than we're used to seeing in Western culture.
Yeah, but I guess what it is that a pentagram?
he brought us a definition of Satanism on his laptop. Right. Should I read it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Satanism is a term that may refer to a religious, semi-religious, and/or philosophical movement. The term is normally applied by non-Satanists to those individuals who worship the entity called Satan and advocate the triumph of evil forces over good in the universe. However, members of the Church of Satan, the most organized satanic group, reject this common association, and they do not actually believe in a being called Satan, and use his name only as a symbolic allusion to certain materialistic and individualistic values. Adherents of the various forms of Satanism recognize Satan as either an archetype, a pre-cosmic force, an actual living entity, and or some aspect of human nature. Although named for Satan, a name associated with evil and temptation, Satanism is also the name given to certain spiritual paths which emphasize the left-hand path as opposed to the much more common right-hand path. Left-handers, I'm one of them, believe in spiritual enrichment through their own work on themselves, and that ultimately they are answerable only to themselves, while right-handers believe in spiritual enrichment through the dissolution of submission of the self or into something greater. Lavaeans do not, in fact, worship a deity called Satan or necessarily any other deity, nor do they follow a principle of evil. This aspect of their beliefs is very commonly misunderstood due to the presence of theistic Satanists who revere Satan as a literal being.
Well, one thing I wanted to add about that is it sounds pretty harmless because I had read about this also, that they believe in the self and just basically they believe in just doing what feels good for yourself. And that may seem harmless, but actually when you think about it, it's pretty scary, because basically what they believe in is just do whatever you want to do. And, you know, maybe it's convenient to kill somebody. You know, just do it. Like, they just don't want to believe that there's any sort of right and wrong, and just whatever feels good to you personally is what you should just do. And so to some people, you know, when the Satanists explain themselves, to some people it sounds pretty harmless. But when you look into it more deeply, when you listen to them talk and you look at and you kind of research it and stop and think about it, it actually gets to be kind of creepy.
See, but I think you can live a life under the philosophy that you are only doing whatever you want to do, like what you're describing, and I think you can do it in a Christian way. For example, like you brought up, maybe you want to kill someone, right?
Right, I mean, maybe you'll make a lot of money off of that.
Right. But killing someone in the long term doesn't actually serve your interests, because you go to jail, you'll feel bad.
Not necessarily.
You might go to jail. You might feel bad. You know, it might feel wrong to do it. It might internally just feel wrong to do it.
But they don't believe in right and wrong. That's the thing. They're trying to eliminate. That's what I'm saying. Like, they're trying to eliminate that internal sense of right and wrong, and that's what sociopaths. Sociopaths don't have that internal sense of right and wrong.
I'm not disagreeing.
I mean, they don't feel bad deep down inside.
No, I understand what you're saying. But what I'm saying is it's interpretive. Just like we were talking before about how different people call themselves Christians and yet essentially practice very different religions, even though they're calling themselves Christians. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm not here to defend the Satanists, because I don't fully understand the whole concept at all. But I can say that if the philosophy is doing only what you want, then I think you can extrapolate that philosophy to include doing the right thing.
You could.
Because, like, I don't, for example, like, I don't steal, right? That's one of the things I don't do.
Right.
And I don't steal not because it's one of the Ten Commandments or because it's something I was taught in religion or anything like that. I don't steal because I don't find it pleasing to steal. It's in my own self-interests not to steal.
Yeah,
I don't do it for the protection of others. Do you know what I mean?
I understand, but see, that's creepy. Because when you, I mean, it is. If you think about that, if you think about this deeply and you apply that to life, if all you're doing is acting in your own self-interest, what does that mean? Ask yourself, what does that mean? You're only acting in your own self-interest?
I derive pleasure from helping people, is that not acting in my own self-interest?
Is
there such a thing as
a
selfless act? If I go down to New Orleans and I help rebuild from the Katrina damage or something like that, and I do it because it gives me a sense of having done something good and that makes me feel good, and really I'm doing it for myself.
Mm-hmm. But you're not doing it completely for yourself. You're also helping them. So it's not just that you're thinking of yourself.
I'm helping them as a function of having of that internalization making me feel good. I wouldn't do it if it didn't make me feel good.
But what I'm saying... Okay, I guess we're out of time.
Oh, we're out of time. How did we get into a religious debate? That's why the time went
Satanism,
flying by.
Right.
Well, from the satanic side, this is John, and from the Christian side,
non-satanic side.
And this has been the Kill Radio Tuesday News. And no, guys, I'm not a Satanist because I actually don't technically.
It's not in his self-interest.
Because it's not in my self-interest to believe in Satan. That's exactly right. We'll be back next week. Goodbye, like goodbye.
Hey, you got some kind of music on your thing, or should I get some music on my thing?
Sounds dirty.